Today's program is brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit cane5.com.
HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Opinion.
Hi, I'm Kimberly Chow. I'm the Managing Director of Food Book Fair. So excited to share with you one of our fantastic panels recorded with Heritage Radio Network at Food Book Fair 2015. One of the panels we put together with our fantastic partner, the New York Academy of Medicine, is about food and empire, exploring how cuisine, cookery, food, eating and drinking explains the world around the world through globalization, colonization, and more.
Wow, applause for doing nothing. Wonderful. I actually direct the library at the New York Academy of Medicine. I'm not going to stay between you and the speakers for very long. I just wanted to say the reason that we're co-sponsoring this is, first of all, with the New York Academy of Medicine, we're interested in how people stay healthy in cities. So that means we do a lot of work around access to healthy foods, food systems, food policy. We also love books. I direct the Library and History Center, and we have about 550,000 books. And 10,000 of those are specifically cookbooks, and you can hear us speaking more about them this afternoon. But amongst the other many hundreds of thousands are books about exploration, books about botany, there's a farming. It's an incredibly broad collection, and so we're really excited to have people here who explore those issues. We also do a lot of programming up at the Academy, which is on Fifth Avenue. You can see our brochures upstairs. And this year we're doing a whole series called Eating Through Time, which, as it suggests, is about different history and food. And Evelyn Kim is our guest curator, so I'll hand over to her. Thank you.
This panel is actually something that's very near and dear to my heart, and mainly because I'll tell you a little story about Spam. When I was growing up as a child, we had a lot of Spam. And if probably most of you know, Spam isn't Korean. So basically, after a number of years, I had finally looked into the history of Spam and why there is this relationship between Spam and Korean food. And a lot of it has to do with the Korean War and issues surrounding the types of foodstuffs that were around during the Korean War when American GIs had come through. So with that, this panel has talked, they're all speakers that have looked upon foodstuffs through various issues of power, hegemony, and whether it's seen or not seen, food is a way of looking. Food is not only symbolic of, but also can be actual instances of particular modes of power. So this entire panel, we're gonna be talking about food as that, as power and as a vehicle that may indicate power or not. I'm going to ask all the panelists to introduce themselves briefly, and then we'll get on to a set of discussion questions. So please, go ahead.
I'm delighted to be here. My name is Rachel Loudon. A year or so ago, I published a big book called Cuisine and Empire. And this is when I have my 5 minutes
yes,
to say who
yes,
I am?
Yes, you are. Okay. This is your 5 minutes.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay, I'd like to make 3 points about why I wrote that book. And I'll begin with, like Evelyn, with an anecdote. When I was a little girl, my father was a farmer. He drove the tractor every day. And one day he decided that it would be very nice to take some of the wheat he grew on his farm and actually turn it into bread himself. So he took some of the wheat and he took it into the kitchen and he pounded it in a pestle and mortar and he got crushed grains. And then he put it in one of those old-fashioned meat grinders that you add to the edge of the table and he ground it. And all he got was squished grains. And then, feeling very frustrated, my mother was slightly relieved because she wasn't going to have to cook this, he put it on the flagstone floor and took a hammer to it and scattered the remains of the grains all over the kitchen. What I realized then was that I could have starved with all those sacks of grain out in the barn. We don't eat plants and we don't eat animals. There's a whole range of things that go on between harvest or slaughter and being able to put stuff into our mouths. Less now than it used to be because we've done so much breeding, but it's still the case that cooking, which I'm using here as a portmanteau word for food preparation, including food processing, is incredibly hard. It's hard to find out how to turn these raw materials into food. It takes lots of energy to do it, and it takes lots of time to do it. So second point, food preparation is at least as important to humans as the farming. The first produces the raw materials, the second turns them into food. Third point, because it is so incredibly hard, when people discover ways of doing it, other people copy that very quickly. And that is one of the most creative and productive processes that has gone on in human history. The transfer of ways of knowing how to turn raw materials into food from one area to another. And if you look back over history, and I say this not pro or anti, the biggest arena for the transfer of ways of turning raw materials into food are empires, because those have been the largest and most powerful political units and therefore areas of exchange. And so if we want to understand where we are today, we have to understand that plants and animals aren't food, that it's very hard to make them food, and that it's this migration and transfer of techniques from one area to another, largely through large states, that's been important.
Fantastic. I don't have to say anything now. My part of the job is, in fact, I would say, if Rachel's work is empire and cuisine, mine is how the empire strikes back. And which is basically migration. And in fact, I'm myself a migrant. I came to the U.S. grad school to work on development and underdevelopment. And I was assaulted by nostalgia, and I started cooking badly, mostly. And I realized that two things. I didn't know how to cook, which of course can only happen to one part of the species, which is male, and can survive, and it's in a South Asian context, where I probably knew how to make an omelet and had made tea a couple of times, and that's not exceptional for a lower middle class boy. In India, cookery is what I call the servant wife complex of cookery, and in fact, I had, so the first thing I realized that I didn't know how to cook, it was easy to learn, I did it badly for a long time, but I was feeding myself and hungry grad students, so kind of they had very low expectations. It was easy. The second part of it, which was startling to me, was that I had never thought about it. And that, of course, was only a privilege of masculinity, South Asian masculinity. And that startled me because I had been part of a progressive movement in South Asia and had been surrounded by feminists. But feminists had been mostly fleeing the kitchen in India because, in fact, these were mostly middle-class feminists. They didn't want to go to cooking. And for me, public politics, progressive politics, was, in fact, a cover, again, of not to do cooking. And I was surprised. So from there, my trajectory started. As I was trying to engage with nostalgia, I was trying to figure out, is this something everybody goes through, every immigrant, and it's slowly expanded into, have other immigrants gone through, how important is cooking to them, how important is taste to them, and it turned out, of course, that it's a long story. So as a sociologist, I did what sociologists do, which is they survey a bunch of folks and find out as to what they're thinking, how typical or atypical it is. So I surveyed 126 households, and then I did an inventory of people's refrigerators because you ask people questions, people say they do something, and then they look, and you look at their refrigerator, it turns out not to be that true because there's a lot of frozen pizza in the refrigerator. That was my first book, which is The Migrant's Table. To quickly give you a sense, what I was intrigued and surprised by was that breakfast for most of my middle-class migrants had completely and quickly changed, other than in the domain of tea. They retained tea drinking, which is very intriguing, because tea drinking mostly in India, though you know most of it is chai, we learned from the British, in fact, it was a very imperial project because most of the tea was grown by the British in plantations in India. But so Indian immigrants to the U.S. Stuck to tea. They didn't move to coffee, but everything else, cereal and milk and toast and eggs, they quickly moved. So if you looked at just breakfast, you would say, wow, they had radically changed their food practices. But if you looked at dinner, dinner was the domain of tradition. In fact, my work amongst Bengali immigrants showed that Bengali food in New York City or in Chicago or in LA or in any of the American cities and suburbs was more Bengali in the US than in Bengal. They ate more rice and more fish more often because they had more money to eat more fish. So in some ways, if you just looked at dinner, dinner had in fact become much more conservatively Bengali. So the question is, so what was going on? Were they acclimatizing? Were they getting kind of Americanized, or were they becoming more traditional in some ways? And the answer is, in fact, both. With breakfast, it's almost like people were preparing to get out into the public American world and shutting the door behind them in some ways and facing outwards. With dinner, it was almost that these men especially were turning their back to American culture, and they were, in some ways, working with this idea of in some ways, a patriarchal idea of the home and the hearth, and most of their wives were doing the cooking, while the children, in fact, had a lot mixed practices. So that was my first book, and my second book was looking at globalization and the Indian middle class, and this it was a co-edited volume called Curried Cultures. And the book I'm supposed to have finished on March 30th, it's on my desk, I have to do one final reading of it, is called The Immigrant Restaurateur and the American City. Because again, when I started looking at data, it looked like, in fact, immigrants had fed Americans for a very long time, not only in the agricultural system, but in fact, what Rachel talks about mostly in the city-based cooking system, that immigrants, we have data in the US on occupations and birthplace from the 1850 census. And in fact, if you look at New York City, predictably 70, 80, 90% of bakers, butchers, barkeepers, saloon keepers are foreign born, Irish and German. And by the way, surgeons, I was surprised to learn 50% of surgeons in New York City were foreign born in the 1850s. It's a little less, of course, if you go out to the rest of the United States, but it's quite substantial. And we have census data up to, of course, the last census, 2010. And those percentages keep up there, adding cooks. Cooks, by the way, were not counted in the census because they were subsumed under servants until 1910. Mm-hmm. Chefs, of course, were not counted. Nobody was counting chefs until 1980, which gives you, in some ways, a social history of categories that become important. So I'm finishing that and moving to the next project, which is on street vendors. So you see a pattern.
Thank you. Sounds great. So continuing this thread of digging into maybe overlooked narratives is what my work is all about. I don't know if we have some visual. If not, no big deal. My name's Natasha Bowens, and I'm the author of The Color of Food, Stories of Race, Resilience, and Farming. Which is a compilation of stories and portraits from farmers of color around the country, a community that is most neglected in this country and makes up the smallest percentage of farm owners in agriculture today. And basically, their stories, through storytelling, these farmers of color all over the country give us insight into barriers and issues in today's food system. You know, being that they are some of the most neglected communities today, however, at the same time, today's food system was built on their backs, continues to be fueling the food system through labor from these communities. And also, these communities have had a huge influence on the foods we eat today, through their food cultures. And I decided to get on the road about 5 years ago and begin this photographic storytelling project where I interviewed farmers from the Black South to Cherokee Appalachia to along the Mexican border in the Southwest and within Hmong communities in the Northwest. And their stories really give us insight into some of the barriers and obstacles in the food system while also showing some of the work that they're doing to push the food movement forward and revolutionizing the food system in their communities. That also gives us a little look into the history of power, injustice, and inequity for these communities around food, while also teaching us that without culture, there is no agriculture. And I decided to do this project as a woman of color who started immersing myself in the food movement and farming myself. I was really confronted with this feeling of needing solidarity and looking around and feeling like the only brown girl farming and kind of getting my crunchy on in the food movement. And so I really started to look at the face of the good food movement and this kind of movement to get back to the land and start farming. And I really thought that this project could do its little part in making these communities more visible and amplifying and preserving and honoring their narratives and what these communities have brought to food and our food system today.
Great, thank you. We're gonna start up with a couple questions. And when I've read all three of your works, one of the things that stood out to me the most is that food is a mechanism for, or a vehicle for control. In whether it's you're hungry and you don't get the food that you need, or you use it as a reward system and in a more psychological sense, or in terms of who gets the food, mm-hmm. i.e. emperors versus slaves, in terms of determining a certain degree of identity. What I'd like to ask all of you is that How are your narratives exemplary of that issue of control? How has that played out historically? How has that played out in contemporary terms? And what does this mean for a more contemporary audience in terms of what we eat every day and how we think about what we eat?
Go
ahead.
Yep.
Rachel, go ahead.
You don't want to shake it up?
I'm boring.
Well, as you've discovered, I do the grand historical scale from the mastery of cooking grains, which happens way before agriculture, 20,000 BC, right up to the present. And until about, my take on this is that for most of the last 22,000 years, the important thing to realize is food was really scarce. It was scarce because agriculture wasn't very productive. It was scarce because processing with human or animal or wind or water labor was very difficult. It was scarce because transport by humans or animals is almost impossible. Everybody suffered from the tyranny of the local unless they were lucky to live in a city on a river or on an ocean. And that means, I think, that for most of history, most people really had very little choice in what they ate. There was this tyranny of the local that I keep returning to. They had very little power, and their lack of power was institutionalized in the fact that they not only had little to eat, but what they ate was different from what the rich ate. The rich ate meat, the rich ate sweets, the rich had produce from afar, a varied diet, plenty of calories. The poor basically ate porridge. 2 points about this. First, although this sounds like the rich had a lot of freedom in food and the poor didn't, because this hierarchy had to be maintained, in fact, the rich were almost as constrained in their food as the poor were. It was much better food, but they had to eat the rich, fancy meals to keep this hierarchy in place. To go to a modern example, the Duke of Edinburgh is supposed to have said, all I ever get is the fancy stuff. I would love to have some ordinary food one day. I mean, it's not a problem I've had, but you can see that it could get very tedious having to eat in this very What happened? About 100 years ago, we found ways of using inanimate energy, fossil fuel energy, to do all that hard work. And because agriculture and processing and transport became so much easier, food became plentiful, not for everybody, but for increasingly large numbers of the human population. And I think today we have far greater freedom to choose what we eat than at any time in human history. It's an incredibly exciting time to be an eater. Are there problems? There are lots of problems, and Chris and Natasha are going to talk about them, but I think that's the background you have to see our current worries against.
I think in my case, in my work, it's astonishing to note that power is exercised primarily by the ability to get away without cooking. And yeah. In fact, those, which kind of twofold, those who cook tend to be the inferior, historically, and its relationships of power. And its consequence in some ways is that cooking itself has been intellectually trivialized, and it's maybe the ground is just beginning to shift, maybe because most of us are not cooking, in fact. And so you see that historically that, I mean, the academy, the institutions I am part of, has for long disdained any attention to cooking. In fact, in European 18th century aesthetic theory, the argument was made by a whole series of philosophers, not coincidentally all of them men, that in fact aesthetics has nothing to do with literal taste. It has to be distant contemplation. You can turn it, if it's architecture, if it's painting, if it's on a wall, if you can't lick it, if you can't bite it, then it's good taste. Good taste has nothing to do with what you can eat. And that's the major argument, almost a consensus emerging in Europe in the 18th century. Which has dominated the academy. That's why we have had no food and drink in the classroom, in the library, in the museum.
And as far as cooks being inferior, you could say the same for the producers of food, farmers, farm workers. Before we kind of started using fossil fuels to mainly run our agriculture, we were using human labor. As we know, the food system and agricultural system here in this country was built on the backs of slaves. Today, you still have modern day slavery with farm workers. So when I think of this using food as control, I think of this very oppressive form of control that is centered around food with our farm producers and our farm workers. And a lot of the farmers that I talk to now, especially black farmers in the South who are descendants of slaves, who come from long lines of sharecroppers, to turn it on its head, they're now finding liberation through growing their own food, right, and running their own farms. And a lot of farmers that I talk to now, we're also looking at this monopolization of our food and how really a very few bodies, emperors, right, control our most significant resource, which is our food, down to the very seed, which is really terrifying. So finding that liberation, now we have young farmers starting seed collectives, saving seed and really fighting for food sovereignty from seed to table, to try to flip that instead of food as a control, using food as a tool for liberation.
Can I add just one more thing? One thing came to my mind is that when, in fact, women and servants leave the household and the job of cooking, it falls in the U.S., the model is falls to industry. And that's what you have, the industrialization of food, in fact, is one answer to the question of who's going to cook.
I actually have a comment on that, but I'm going to repress that because we have a lot of topics to talk about. The other issue I want to talk about, and this goes along with the issue of control and questions of liberation, is all three of you also talk about migrations, whether it is on a grand scale or whether it's on a more local scale. With every migration of persons, there's a migration of food and food cultures. what happens to food cultures when it moves from one place to another? How does it transform? The acceptance, the rejection of food cultures, and there's another and bonus round, the forced migration. Mm. For many of these people, the idea of migration is not necessarily something that's voluntary. Mm-hmm. I think both for Natasha with Mexican laborers, that's one issue, or the Hmong, that's one issue. Mm-hmm. And Rachel, of course, in your book, when you talk about displacement through war or other mm-hmm. types mm-hmm. of other types of kind of violent episodes, and even now currently climate change is going to be a huge issue in terms mm-hmm. of displacement and displacement of persons and cultures. Mm-hmm. So the question is, what happens to food when it moves across borders?
I like to kind of slightly rephrase that, because this assumes that the natural way for humans or for plants to be is in place. Mm. And as my mother used to say, oh, Rachel, when are you going to put down your roots? Mm. And it's a kind of tree metaphor of human life and human civilization. And I used to say, well, you know, trees, they put out their leaves and they get their food from the breezes blowing around. And movement, in this case, it's movement of the air, but movement of people. If you look at human history, yes, it's true that most people perhaps stayed in place. But I think when you look at the history of food, it's movement that really is what drives food. So whether it's not that food moves, obviously people move. People move with ideas. People move with their techniques. People move with their seeds. And whether or not it is forced or voluntary, you can never transfer these things completely unchanged. Mm. They're always changed in a new place, but it is, I'd like to see that moved much more center in the discussion, rather than seeing it as the anomaly and the exception and as something that we should draw back from. I'd like to put it up front as this incredibly productive process, even at human cost. But that human cost of movement has been often liberation as much as, staying in place is not necessarily liberating if you're a peasant. So I don't think we can assume that migration is necessarily, you know, something that is worse for people. People escape, people move, they go somewhere else. They both things.
And I think in some ways, I see it as there are two sources of culture. It's about roots and it's about routes of dispersal. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You get human culture have always been both those things simultaneously. It's about movement. And it's about emplacement in some ways. And the second thing to note is what Sidney Mintz says, people are very conservative about their food habits until they change their mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so, and the most dramatically you see, for instance, examples, which is often linked to, this is the third point, linked to hierarchies of taste, and I think they're linked to global hierarchies, which is mostly, I think, unfortunately, follows capital. What I mean by that is this. If you look at American Japanese writing about food, 1939, there's a beautiful article in the first article on food in the American Journal of Sociology. Masuoka writes that the second generation, the Issei and Nisei generation, are interacting with food, Japanese food in Hawaii, and everybody is convinced that Japanese food is just inferior and terrible. The kids are getting trained in school to come and teach their parents how to eat like Americans. And Japanese parents are feeling defensive, and they're convinced that their food is inferior. From 1939, and you flip it, you make it 1989. And now we are filled with this idea that the Japanese food is the best in the world. The most expensive restaurant in New York City is a Japanese restaurant. And in fact, the most expensive restaurants in the U.S. now are Japanese restaurants, which is very interesting. And that is astonishing, that change. And that change is, of course, linked to the rise of Japan as a power, as an economic power, and in fact, subsequently as a cultural power. No other cuisine has broken through, no other non-European cuisine has broken through that barrier. Japanese is the first, and it's not a coincidence. Korean might be next if it continues the same pathway. 50 years from now, maybe we'll get to the Chinese and where we can break through the barrier of $30 barrier of entree costs, where Chinese and Indian restaurants and Thai restaurants cannot charge more than about maximum 15, with some exceptions. While Japanese and American and now Italian and now Greek and now Spanish have all broken through that barrier. That is very interesting, that history.
And the same can be said almost for soul food now, which is really interesting. And I think there was another question that you had that you maybe raised later where I want to talk a little bit more about that. But getting back to what Rachel said, I feel like I could agree on some level, you know, just acknowledging the inevitable evolution of food culture with migration, and it has to move. But when we're talking about forced migration and looking at what it's done for communities and their traditional food ways to have lost their land, lost their regional food culture, I think that's when it gets a little different. And, you know, talking with some of the Cherokee farmers that I spoke with in North Carolina who, you know, throughout their history had access to land as wide as 8 states before they were forced to move, and now have about 56,000 acres on their reservation next to the 11 million acre Great Smoky Mountains National Park, where they used to be able to practice their traditional food ways of harvesting wild foods, heirloom Cherokee foods and plants, hunting, and now in the name of conservation, they are no longer allowed to go into this space, into these lands, and practice their traditional food ways. So they've lost that food culture because of this forced migration, which is often, obviously, results in land loss. So I'd just like to insert that kind of piece in there when we're talking about forced migration and instead of what happens to the food, but the loss of food culture and the loss of traditional food ways.
Well, I mean, that's really interesting you mentioned that because with, especially, and this is with the Chris's work on restaurateurs and immigrant restaurateurs, you see a loss of when you see immigrants take their food and put up new restaurants, there is going to be something lost. And people who are like me, who are like authenticity hunters in terms of food, it's like, oh, well, this is not the way my grandma made Korean food, or this is the worst kimchi I've ever had, that this is just all wrong. You know, there's the question of authenticity is something that we as consumers think about. But if you are a producer, if you are the immigrant that actually makes the food, there's a very different relationship in terms of marketing your food and the economics of, well, is this going to be viable as a business plan? So I want Chris to talk maybe a little bit, touch a little bit on that relationship and how the immigrant, how loss may be something that's intentional and not something that's necessarily seen as a poor thing.
In some ways, I would say first that authenticity is the search for a true copy, which of course is a nice way to think about it, which is in some ways an engagement with your exposure and expectation. The second thing related to it, I think, is authenticity is the anxiety produced by access. If we don't have access, we don't think much about authenticity. Once we get it and everybody else gets it, then it becomes this quarrel over whose is most authentic. So in some ways, to use an old-fashioned Marxist or Hegelian word of dialectic of between access and the search of the true copy is, in fact, which of course is, I see all these are transactions in taste and constructions of histories. Like, say, is chicken tikka masala inauthentic? Mm-hmm. Now it is the the authentically inauthentic Indian dish now. Yeah. Okay, so now it is going back to India as because now Indians also want chicken tikka masala because we just had butter chicken and we didn't have enough tomato sauce in it. So chicken tikka masala is what we already had in northern India, butter chicken plus the tomato sauce, maybe the spice dialed down a little. So in some ways, which is this circulation of cultures, including not only that does the empire strike back, but in fact the imperial, the circulation between the imperial center and the periphery in some domains hastens and in others slows down. Mm-hmm. And that's the interesting story. I mean, like for instance, Indians picked up all their drinking habits from the Brits. Mm-hmm. Rarely any of the solid food habits. Mm-hmm. The Brits picked up a lot of the solid food habits from the periphery. And I think these are different kinds of relationships. Mm-hmm. This, the French colonial experience is different. Mm-hmm. If you look at baguettes and Vietnam, for instance, the Spanish colonial experience is different. And each of these stories are interesting stories about how power and taste relate to each other and flow in interesting directions so that Rachel can write a whole book about it.
Yes, and I think, just to chime in on sort of power and empire, and I've got things on authenticity too, but, we have often this view that an empire is this sort of all-powerful thing out there. There's a quip among historians that most empires are, in fact, cities joined by a trade route network, and that most of the rest of the area is sort of out there and barely under control. I mean, empires, does the empire strike back, or does the empire always win? In the long run, the empires never win. The whole history of the world is empires that ended. And so I think when we're talking about empires, the sort of picture that you sometimes have that, you know, there's some Rome or London or New York or, you know, that is sort of pushing their will out on the periphery. They do. They would like to be, but, you know, there's an awful lot of people out there who are pushing back all the time. And it's a much, much more complicated question than just simply capital cities and armies overtaking large areas.
Mm-hmm. And in fact,
as with, you know, people going with their, you know, preserving their food ways under very difficult conditions.
And in fact, the most important modern empires have failed to impose their food habits on others.
Yeah.
In fact, it's the second best empires that have been the best about food. The French lost everything else other than haute cuisine and couture and maybe set like the world of sensory world. And there's a beautiful work on how come the French appropriated that, while the Brits never, in fact, won the battle on food, and the Americans barely won the battle on food.
You can't impose your food on a whole empire. It's just economically and physically impossible.
And I think that's what's inspiring about some of the stories in the book and why the resilience made its way into the subtitle, because just what I pulled from a lot of these communities, like the Gullah Geechee farmers that I interviewed, right, this very small community that's rooted in West Africa from the days of slavery, isolated on the coast of South Carolina, against the empire, still have preserved their food culture. And some of the farmers I interviewed there were continuing to pass that down to youth, bringing them onto the farm, teaching them the story of rice and the history and how to cook Gullah cuisine. And I just find that resilience and fight really inspiring.
That actually brings the question of all of you have discussed issues around class and either in the subaltern, slaves, whether or people who are at risk. What in terms of the Gullah Geechee, what, if I remember correctly, a number of years ago, there was an issue about territoriality in terms of who had the land, and it was a huge land fight. And one of the issues had been that who were the descendants of the Gullah Geechee, and they were trying to buy back the land. It's a complicated question, but it's one could say that the haves and the have-nots are one of the biggest determinants of food and food culture. And there's often class structures, whether it's in the farm or whether it's in the kitchen. If the empire does strike back, how do these people, I love these stories, especially when, you know, with Crescendo about how these, you know, lower middle class Bengalis or Indian communities come through and make it very, very successful businesses. How does that come about? How does that happen? And historically, you can definitely see that whether in food cultures and in terms of taking a look at the types of cuisine that remains popular mm-hmm. or doesn't remain popular. Mm-hmm. Any of you? Go for it.
I mean, in some ways, it's again the thing. One, we like to eat our own food, and then we love to eat other people's food. And part of it is, who are these others? And kind of American history is what I find is fantastic. What I find very compelling about the American food culture is, in fact, that open-mindedness. Mm-hmm. And I think that open-mindedness is linked, in fact, to a lack of terroir. Terroir can go hand in hand very well with xenophobia, absolutely. Cultural xenophobia. Mm-hmm. That precise open-mindedness is also opens us to chasing all kinds of will-o'-wisps and fashions mm-hmm. and food. And I like it like that mm-hmm. as an immigrant.
No, I'd like to second that. I agree entirely. The notion that there is some food connected to some place that people have control over mm-hmm. Can be a wonderful and sense of identity and belonging, but it can also be, as recent events in Italy showed, where if you don't know them, there were huge debates about whether or not couscous could be served in restaurants in certain areas of North Italy because that was immigrant food. And polenta was supposed to be the local food, which, of course, immediately everybody who knew anything about food history pointed out was, in fact, an imported food. There is no spot on the earth that has an original food that goes mm. all the way back. We're all the beneficiaries of these exchanges.
Mm. And I think some, to some extent, just clinging to food as something to cling to, right, when you are in a new place, cling to that piece of home. There was a farmer that I interviewed from Laos that, you know, she grew a variety of vegetables, and I was asking her what she might have grown from home. And when I first arrived on her farm, she was very modest about her amazing farm and what she grew, but her face lit up when she wanted to take me to the cassava tree and to the bamboo that she had and some of the other crops that she was growing. And you could tell where her passion was, and it was just really about a piece of home, bringing a piece of home mm-hmm. that she was now bringing to market mm-hmm. and bringing into other consumers' lives. Mm-hmm. And so I definitely think that piece is very important.
And I think I would call that, it's absolutely compelling, exactly opposite of what I was saying, and I think that's important, is strategic essentialism. Mm. And that's kind of, that's a strategic essentialism, that this is me. Fish makes a Bengali, rice and fish makes a Bengali. So insist on eating it. And in fact, the fact that both are relatively recent and available because mm-hmm. of affluence, mm-hmm. okay? Mm-hmm. But to in some ways be subjects with any sense of integrity, we have to also claim these hypothetical positions of strategic essentialism, mm-hmm. Of that this, in fact, in Bengali, there's a saying, bhate mache bangali, which means rice and fish makes a Bengali, okay? Which is partly linked to territory, land, and its accidents in terms of accidents of geography and accidents of history. And then, and that's the fun part of the story. So is chicken tikka masala authentic English food, or is it fish and chips? Of course, fish and chips is the last group of cohort of immigrants, which is Jewish immigrants, who gave the English their fish and chips. So which one are you going to claim? You claim one depending on your politics. If you don't like the current cohort, maybe you want to go back to fish and chips, whom you may not have liked anyway in the first place. So kind of this is the strategic engagement, which is in some ways, which is tradition is real and important, and tradition is continuously invented.
And I think often these national foods are in fact like authentic foods, invented by outsiders. Mm.
I didn't know I was eating Indian food until I left India.
No, I mean, and if you, I've been very interested in how outsiders, you know, say, well, the national food of England is fish and chips. I mean, I am about as English as you can possibly get, and I never had fish and chips until I returned from the United States mm-hmm. when I was 30 years old. It's mm-hmm. urban food, and I grew up in the country, and nobody knew in the country that there was such a thing as fish and chips. Mm-hmm. It just didn't exist. And, you know, conversely, everybody knows that hamburger is American food, where, you know, most Americans would say many other things make up their food. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows that tacos are Mexican food, which, again, is, you know, an overstatement, to put it mildly. Mm-hmm. Or curry is Indian food, when, in any of the understandings that most people had until recently, this is a British construction. Mm-hmm. So I think when one's talking about national foods, one has to be awfully careful about who is saying these. This is where your identity lies.
You know, that's really... I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I just wanted to say, and I think it restricts communities in a way. Now, thinking about this and just thinking about, you know, one of the reasons that I felt a little out of place, and if I felt out of place, then surely other people of color, other black folks felt out of place in this good food movement, because we're supposed to be eating, you know, soul food. And so to have a vegan, there's a vegan sister. Yeah. She has a cookbook out. And you know, it's like, what? You're vegan? What? Like, why aren't you eating, you know, fried okra, and fried chicken?
Really, because Brian Terry makes a similar argument in terms of
exactly
in terms of his books that he's done in the past with, you know, the Afro-vegan, and he actually has pointed out and reintroduced the idea to a larger audience. Well, this was always part
right
of our culture. The idea of vegan is not anything new, but right. but once again, it's the outsider who decides to define,
yeah.
You know, or in the case of xenophobia, I mean, I know in Denmark, they just had a vote on what is the national dish of Denmark. Yeah, and it's this horrible, horrible, disgusting thing called, well, I'm sorry, that's my, maybe you'll like it, called Fleskestai, and it's basically, basically pork belly that's just crisped up till it's dead with a bunch of braised cabbage. Mm-hmm. And every single other Dane I know of said, oh my God, how could that be our national dish? Who voted for this? So, you know, and everyone said, well, there are other versions of what there are. But once again, it's the question of, well, who decides? Yeah. Who's going to be the one that defines what these mm-hmm. these foods are? Mm-hmm. I want to open the floor to questions, because I didn't even get to all the questions I wanted to ask, simply because these topics are really, really complex and they're fascinating. So if anyone else has a question to these wonderful panelists, please raise your hand.
Yes and no, yeah. Right? And it's the point is, yes, as I said, I think anthropologists are showing, people are conservative about their tastes until they change their mind.
Yeah.
And the point is, what do you want to get out of it? And I don't think any of these things are innately good, bad, or ugly. Mm-hmm. The point is this, I think it's dialogic. It's often engaged. If we are arguing about food, it's probably already a food fight. And if it's a food fight, there are all kinds of stakes. And I think for me, in terms of analysis, then to raise what are those stakes people have in these fights and what is worth fighting for. So I would argue local, sustainable food is worth fighting for in one way. In other ways, for other reasons, mobile food is worth fighting for in other ways. If I was in Lucca in Italy, I'll be fighting for doner kebabs in the city center. Mm-hmm. Just because, for me, livelihoods of poor people are as important as food cultures. And so I would take a story. That doesn't mean you should take that position. No. It only means as we figure out in the course of the food fight, which side and what stakes do you want to play for?
Yeah, actually, I kind of want to make a comment on that. That's in Denmark, one of the issues about the national food was the issue of the donor kebab. And one of the problems that has come up has been issues over immigration and halal food in mm-hmm. public school mm-hmm. systems. So the idea that it's quintessentially this pork dish, mm-hmm. despite the fact that there is a large immigrant population mm-hmm. that has halal practices and refuses to eat pork, also makes a political statement mm-hmm. about what kind of country are we, mm-hmm. and especially considering the contemporary debates over immigration in Europe right now, it's not just about saying, oh, this horrible pork dish is our national dish. The stakes are much, much higher.
Yeah. And I think we're in a time when heritage rides very high. We're all trying, UNESCO, the European Union. I mean, there's a whole heritage industry business out there. Mm-hmm. What I always want to ask is, what things, we can't preserve everything. The world is littered with cuisines yeah. that have gone and vanished, and probably many of them for the good. Why? What ones do we want to maintain, or what parts and why? Which gets back to Chris's point.
Yeah, and
your point.
On the flip side is, and this is me being extremely cynical, which is that one can argue that the heritage UNESCO thing has more to do with trade and economics.
Right, exactly. Absolutely.
Yeah, than it yeah. has anything to do with, we can all feel good, oh, it's a slow food movement, it's like, no, it's someone's out there to make a buttload of money.
Mm-hmm. Culinary tourism.
Yeah, exactly. Any other questions?
I just wanted to say that, and we also have to remember that food is not its separate entity. It's connected to many things. It's connected to land. It's connected to survival of people, right? So I think what I saw with people wanting to preserve food culture was not only just preserving food culture for that authenticity, just to preserve food culture, but trying to bring back a connection to food and to land in the community that has lost that connection and what has resulted from that loss, right? We don't own our land. We don't have ownership over our health because we're dependent on this broken food system, particularly in communities of color who are impacted by a system and seeing health problems that never existed in communities before and now have rampant rates of obesity and diabetes. So I think trying to bring back that food culture and maintain food culture is getting at these other issues that it's connected to, and that's why it was important, like you were saying, what's at stake there. Yeah. So I just wanted to add that.
Do we have time for one more? Oh, we have. Okay, we have time for one more question. Anyone? Bueller? Okay, panelists, it's now your time to ask each other questions. So if any of you have questions about each other's work, otherwise I'm going to come up with one.
Go ahead.
Okay, the one thing I wanted to ask, and this is somewhat specifically to Rachel, but I think others can make comments about it, is that you've made this is a historiographic point. You call the book Cuisine and Empire, as opposed to Food and Empire, or anything else. I mean,
I'd like to get rid of the word food. I mean, it's a real bugbear for me. Because supposing we're talking about the history of clothing, and we started off and we told a history of silkworm cultivation and sheep herding, somebody would come along and say, well, what about weaving and spinning and textiles and dyeing and sewing? But we use this portmanteau word food to cover everything from, growing stuff right up to what we put in our mouths. And I think it clouds lots of issues. Because I wanted to concentrate on the important, giving cookery, which as Chris said, has not been given its due. And it is this, and I stress again, I include everything. Preparation, processing, cleaning, cooking, all the mechanical, chemical, biochemical, and thermal processes we use to turn resources into food. I wanted to draw attention to that. And so when we do that, we do it in organized ways. If we discover one technique, we will use it for lots and lots of different things. If we can grind grains, we can grind oil seeds, we can grind meat, we can grind all kinds of other things. So we have organized styles of food preparation. That's what I mean by a cuisine. I don't mean high cuisine or humble cuisine. I mean, whatever the style of food preparation is. And I think that's really important, because if you talk about food, it sounds like you're going around kind of snacking off different things. We eat in an organized way, and we eat in an organized way because we cook.
So, I mean, so basically what it sounds like, and maybe I'm reading too much into this, this book is as much a book about food history, you know, in a large sense, as it is a history of technology.
Yes, because the technology is absolutely crucial. Unless we've got techniques for turning plants and animals into food, we are not human. I mean, humans do that.
And I would say, in fact, technology in a double sense, having read, I'm almost halfway through Rachel's book, is technology as is in terms of cooking techniques.
Yes,
but I think cuisine happens when cooking leaves the kitchen. It's a double form, which is both the process of making it and the process of representing it. That is, cuisine in this case, I think, is partly linked to also the printing press, just as right now cuisine is linked to social media. That is, if people don't see what you ate, you haven't eaten yet.
I would put it differently from that, because I think I would say that the idea that techniques stand by themselves, they don't. Techniques are a means to an end. And we have ideas. And we have ideas about what is good to put in our mouths. And those ideas are connected to our religious beliefs, to our moral beliefs, to our beliefs about what is a good society, to our beliefs about our bodies, our health, and our beliefs about the natural world. And we bring all those ideas and kind of focus them down to, and those shape the techniques that we're going to use to turn plants and animals into food.
I think that's all the time we have. Thank you, panelists, for an amazing set. And I believe there's a book signing.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.